Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
the wave-like properties of light. So if you said it to a teacher, they'd know immediately cued, I will have to teach the fact that light can bend a little bit around corners, and light can scatter, do all sorts of things, sort of similar to a rock being dropped into a pond, and I looked at the ripples come out, and the ripples hit a leaf or a frog and go around it. And so what I'm going to do is try and add a little bit of extra information into this. Now, there's this... The idea I have in my head is that teachers live in an artificial world where there's evidently knowledge out there, but they feel somehow they have the gift of knowing what knowledge is not relevant without knowing the knowledge. Okay, and so therefore they can say, that book or that calculation, you don't need to know it. But I don't understand it, but I know that you don't need to know it. Sort of an act of faith. And so you have these players here who are ignorant of their own ignorance. Now, I'm just going to stop this for the moment before I go into light. I should go into light. So light is like a pond where you drop a petal in. Dropping a petal in the pond is similar to an antenna. An antenna in your mobile phone produces light. Atoms produce light. So antenna produce lights, but they don't even have this. There is a phenomenon that there's light. So if I can quite get into it, they have a series of beliefs which are not ambiguous. They are contradictory to the evidence, visual evidence around yourself. So you have present them a series of visual evidence, and then they say it means that. So in essence, you do a double blow. You actually, if someone had the kinetic powers of observation, you would train them not to observe that, and then you also do a double blow of training them not to do it. So they have this idea that space is a void. Like, if I draw, the only void of space is, the only space that has a void is they have a lack of knowledge of space. Space has permittivity and permutivity of space. These are numbers. They're sort of like numbers of sausages in the fridge or ants in a colony. These are physical numbers, and they talk about the springiness of space, the recoil of space. And so space doesn't have mass, and unlike unlike my conception of a brick, a brick can look at to me different ways. That a brick, if I'm holding a brick in my hand in a car, it's very okay. But if I throw a brick out the window, it will travel along and knock a pensioner over. So that brick is very much different. And so they have the same concept of space being like that, being frame dependent, in their frame dependent physics that they discuss of it. But we say that light, that space doesn't have a frame. So, and space is something for which Einstein's postulates occur. That is, the speed of light is the same, and it's frame independent. You can be fast or slow. It's the same speed direction independent, and it doesn't have mass. So there's all these things which I get into a class and I teach people what a medium is, and I'm really a bit unclear and unclarity. And I do it, and I teach them, and I prove, and I teach them to respond to me correctly. And I therefore have the idea that I have taught someone correctly to the point that I can measure my own incompetence in teaching them. So that's pretty much at the heart of it. So you have someone who really doesn't understand space. They don't understand their own ignorance, and then in that situation, they can actually speak to a certain point and get people to respond, recite their ignorance back to them, and for which then they say, well, they have achieved this point. Now, what happens is that if anyone really has to go, they have to actually undo the work that they've done and then move forward. And if they move forward, say, to a point, double their knowledge. So if they want to, you give them a unit of knowledge and they want to double their knowledge, what happens is that they have to move three times as far, because they have to go through, negate your knowledge, re-equate it, and then move that next step. Now, the ignorant teacher will say, oh, look, that particular student there has gone to university and it hasn't affected him, and because they've never interviewed them and to say, look, I've had to spend all my time unlearning your unclarities which go across. And so this is the story behind this, of how I've got into discussing this. This is the Lighthouse Way properties, is that by chance I was setting up a Google Docs, and in my Google Docs I had shared a copy of recent teacher notes of a fellow who's still blessed by the system, or a fellow teacher, I'm going to specify the sex of them, fellow teacher who is still blessed by the system and has never ever had difficulty teaching what's just in front of them, because it's easy. If I don't challenge any thought and I just follow what's within, and I follow within, my students may miraculously do well or do poorly, especially if they actually probe some probing information from a different angle of understanding. But if I see this little thing, I will go forward. And so they've reduced this thing of saying, given that you cannot explain why light is a wave, you start off with saying, light looks like a wave. It has the property of looking like a wave. And my gosh, it looks like something else which definitely does have a wave. This is, if I put a pebble into a pond, it will radiate out in a circle and then go around in an area. Is it a wave or is it a particle? Again, an ambiguity, a conversation you don't have to have. You only have to have that conversation is if you are a bit of allow yourself to have a bit of quantum physics, but then only enough to produce the light, and then you have classical physics measurement devices, you then have to have particles. So it depends. You can do the entire thing with quantum physics and waves, and there's no aspect of it. Now, the bottom line is that this person will say, these people say, wave-particle duality, we can't describe it here, scientists don't know. And you say, oh, no, look, excuse me, I am a scientist, I do know, and look, I've published papers on it, I do understand it. The response is, I have this other gear, which is basically machine guns come out of the front of my car, and I can blow you away. I have my university lecturer who is, and when I research it, ultimately a fool, or I've never ever studied it, I've only ever read my little book to come across. And if I haven't got the logic to understand light, I definitely can prove the continuity that I have not the logic to understand what you're going across. What I'd like to do is that we are in a state, once you're in a state of knowing a little bit more, your interaction changes with these people, and you can't actually sort of discuss the interaction. I want to actually go back and do the Beatrix Potter. This is a children's writer, and she was an illustrator, and she had the children's voice where she could actually be with the child and do a little bit of transition. So this is not, you know, where people often like children's stories because lots happens in it. She was sitting there as a kindly person, and she wrote the tale of Jemima Puddle Duck. And if you can imagine these beautifully femininely drawn beasts, which were which wore a bonnet and a cape hat and all this type of stuff, and the animals were dressed, so it was enough to actually, being dressed, they had speaking, and they had, it sort of brought you up into them. And what had happened is Jemima had spoken to a fox. The fox had said, "Look, come lay your egg in my lair, and come lay as many as you want, and come up and come and go here." And these people would say, "Oh, this is not good news. This is a fox, and you know enough of it." And the kid can see the fox and see the duck, and then there's a bit of tension, and then which you're taken up to this next level. Beatrix Popper writes the lines, "Jemima Puddle Duck was a simpleton." Jemima Puddle Duck, it's one word, was a simpleton. Five words. In those five words, the child is transformed into a different thing. This is stating as it is and moving across the barrier. The child has moved across the barrier. The story goes in that Jemima then discloses what's going on to the helpy dog. The dog pricks up an ear and says, "Jemima, I'm not going to bother explaining it to you, but can you take me to where your egg is?" Goes around, fights the wolf and eats the egg and stuff like that. And part of that, the beauty of it, is eating egg is a bit of tension. You know, something bad happening gets the person really engaged. Oh, and Jemima wasn't happy, but Jemima hasn't understood. But and nothing's ever explained to Jemima, and that goes on the state of ignorance. And to a certain extent, it's true is for teachers. You will never be able to explain advanced physics to them. You cannot explain to them what the square root of minus one is and various things, but I'm going to try and explain a little bit to you. So they are the Jemima Puddle Ducks. They're not simpletons, however, they're not capable of listening. They're only capable of emotive feeling of superiority, which comes across that they have gained a feeling of superiority for being a student who's already been in the class, a student who knows what to behave, how to fool the examiners into believing you understand it, because there is no understanding it. So we are in this process in terms of that the teachers are simpletons. But we're not going up to the teachers and saying, "Look, you are simpletons." So, look, it's a bit more complex here. That indeed, the mistake made is that space is empty. Space is not a medium. Space is not a medium in the sense that a medium has mass, and it a medium in the way that we teach it doesn't automatically follow to Einstein's special relativity. In fact, the important aspect is that not only do they teach special relativity as an add-on to a sort of medieval view of space, so what they do is they say, We've got this medieval view of space, which is angel time. Every point in space occurs at the same time. So if I have a block of space, it's got the clock ticking across that space is for the entire volume of space. And that's angel time. And it's a medieval view of space, a classical view of space. But then I move up in level, and I teach special relativity, and I can teach a bit of special relativity on this poor background. Now, this poor background also has this issue of explaining light. If you have the speed of light built into space, you can have induced electric field time retarded. So every time I measure the electric field change up here, it corresponds to the electric field induced from the antenna at that time in angel time, except it's taken that amount of time across. If I work further out, I walk further back in time, I could, as I walk, say if I could freeze the frame, I could walk in space and I would actually see the thing move up. It's called retarded potential. But let's talk about a few other things. There's space has properties of permittivity and permeability. And we do teach Faraday's law of induction. Law of induction says that the curl of E is equal to the change of flux through a volume, through a surface area. Now, curl is, what can I say? Because they don't know maths, and the maths is taught poorly, no one actually really knows what curl is, and I've definitely not seen it so far explained in a book properly. So they're sort of lost by certain things. So even if they felt, oh God, I would like to go to a book and understand it, they don't have the actual fundamental understanding. So let's stop for a while. You can get electric fields, and bear in mind, every time I talk about something, 10% of what's required to know and is taught in school, less. So you get two types of electric field lines. I can get an electric field line which starts at a positive charge and ends at a negative charge. And I can do that by just definition. I can ram it into my head. That's a charge-ended field line. Or I can produce another field line by an induced loop field. And so I can actually create a circle of field lines. This is the field lines actually connects to itself. And that's induced. And you say, well, that is absolutely bloody amazing. If I put a charge in that loop and I got it to go round, it will pick up energy each time it goes around. That would be really impossible. That's insane. That's in fact what a transformer is. It's a loop electric field line, and I loop my wire around it and just pick up, I add up the battery charge. And so if I've got 100, 1 volt per loop, 100 loops, I get 100 volts out of it. So you could explain it that way, and it would all stick together. But the fact that you don't tell people that electric field lines can be loops means that your lack of knowledge is actually forcing the kids to learn a lot more, a lot harder. You get a lot greater percentage of kids losing it. And you're at this position of saying, because I have stuffed up teaching so far, I'm now forced to teach the next step with no basis. I have all the bases available for me, but I have to now teach it, saying that I observe the answer the answer, it's like the heuristic nightmare. I observe the answer. I observe the same answer in a different context, therefore the answer. So essentially you have really explained nothing. It's a bizarre thing. So let's go to what curl is. Curl of a vector. So what is curl of a vector? Let's take a vector. So imagine I have a 10 centimeter length of coat hanger wire. I've cut it off, and that corresponds to a vector. I can actually point it towards my face and hold it 10 centimeters away from my face. That's 10 centimeters long pointing to my face. Or I could point it to my tummy, and if I push it in my tummy, that vector would definitely point in the direction of my tummy. Or I could point it between my two hands, so it's got directional length. So that's one aspect of it. If there's one, the divergence or gradient of that vector, you can go. But I want to talk about curl. Curl, if I get that vector and actually do a little bend in it, that will then, if I put it on the ground, on the tabletop, it will sit flat on that table with that bend. And I can imagine a vector up, sticking up on the table, where the length of that vector is equal to the curl or the torque or the bending of it. So the curl is the curl. The curl of a vector is the curl of a vector. I know people are doing a lot of things, but the more that I curl a vector, the bigger and the longer its curl is, the length of the vector. Now, this is important because you've got two induction laws. There are two symmetric induction laws. There's Faraday's law of electric induction, that is, magnetic field, magnetic induction of an electric field. And there's Maxwell's law of magnetic induction by changing electric field. That they are the same maths across the third and fourth Maxwell's equation. Maxwell eventually, when he died, I think he had 20 equations, and people have slowly whittled it together and made it smaller and stuff like that. Basically, all he did was saying, well, he was like a collector. He collected the equations together and could see that there was some explanation for a wave. And you have to get these things called vector potentials. It's electric field potentials. And one of the things is, by our method of teaching, we teach electric field potential in such a way that we make it very difficult to understand vector field potential. Vector field potential we could measure if we had a way of actually bringing a curved magnetic field potential A. So A, curl A equals B, which is the equivalent of saying div B equals zero. The divergence, the B is very much derivative thinking aid of something much more physical, which is the vector potential. Similarly, the electric field is a thinking aid that helps us work out what a potential means. But if I want to, I can physically measure potential very well, because if I've got a potential space, a field potential. So now a field actually means a three-dimensional area of space where that three-dimensional area of space has values associated with it. And I can have a potential field in there by actually putting in a little pipe and taking that value of potential field line and bring it across to a machine which is fixed, which measures a known field drop between a known set of things, and then another little pipe which goes to the bottom and goes to another point. That little pipe, where there is no electric field drop from those points, is called a wire. And so I can actually I have a machine which could do potential distance, so it makes it much more concrete available. But electric field, magnetic field potential is a lot more difficult. It's got a symbol A. Now, the bottom line is that there are two types of fields. There's the point-to-point, positive to negative charge one, and the loop ones. Now, the loop ones form when you create a changing current or a changing field between them. It swirls around. Now, that swirling around is got energy associated with it. So, indeed, if you have anything and you pump it with a variable electric field, it will store energy in the electric field around it. So, what do I mean by this in terms of that? If I could have a capacitor with void in it, there'd be no electric field between it because it's a proper void. But if I put ordinary space from our universe in it, it will have an electric field go through it, and that electric field will be stored in that space. So how can space, empty space, store energy? The bottom line is that it can, because it's not void space, it's full of its compressible material. So if I'm getting light from the sun, that means that it takes 8 minutes for the light from the sun to reach Earth. So if I could just switch off the sun, I'd have 8 minutes worth of energy sunlight coming into me as that light swept through space, and the space would be relaxing, and so it would have an energy wave inside the space. So, I mean, the fact that space can store energy is your microwave, your laser beam, everything like that is—it's just so intense there. Now, what actually happens is that if I put energy into space, it will store into space. But then, when I stop supplying energy, the space will recoil and store the energy out. So there's an oscillator always puts energy into surrounding space. But if it does it at the right frequency, that light, that space, will then put as much energy into space going out and in, and it will begin to radiate. So when it hits the right frequency, and there's a retarded potential, that is that at a particular point I can see not only the space producing the next amount of energy, but the actual oscillator behind it is also going up at the same rate, it will mean that the energy will go into that next unit. And if I go back, I can just... So essentially, what happens is, say, if I have a light source, the propagation of that next piece of space, which is getting energized, is due to the radiation effect of all the other oscillations behind it. And as it builds up, it actually attenuates the light behind it. In fact, that's the way that it operates. It's a ripple coming out. There's the corresponding between it. And the loop of electric field produces a loop, another intersecting, overlapping donut of the magnetic field. And when those two fields are together, electric and magnetic field oscillate in the same way, they project and radiate into the next area of space. How else does it do it? What is generating light into that next section of space? It's the energy stored in the previous energy of space, and it's cancelling out the energy before it and adding the wave in front of it. So that's your wave property of light. And you can understand it, and it's just a matter of taking days, if not months, and working through classical dynamics books and taking the time to understand it. And it takes time, and it takes energy and effort, and you can say no one understands it, but then you'd be saying a lie. Maxwell understood it. People designing mobile phones have understood it. You could understand if you, you stood there, but essentially, when you are telling a kid that the space is empty, and it is always empty, and you say, for instance, of one of the things you heard this podcast, and you would say, well, look, I judge this podcast as not relevant, I'm not going to tell a kid about it ever. And so you can create this zone of ignorance, and that kid will be not distracted, and they'll be conditioned to respond more favorably in the way that you want. So we go across here. Now, the other really intensely interesting issue is the fact that I have oscillators, and I can change the phase of the oscillators across it and produce something out of it. So at the moment, I can see light can hit something, and I can observe its diffraction around the outside. But this is the amazing thing, because this is sort of locked into a way of thinking of denial of ideas and a sort of a quasi-religious sort of a golden era. So in religion, there's the golden era of Jesus, and he didn't have tweets, he didn't have people with mobile phones. When he spoke, everyone had only the option to listen to what he said. Because they had no writing or anything like that, they had to listen and respond in a live fashion. And it was a great time, and it was clear he was here, and the Romans were over there. It's nice and clear. And this is a magical time for which Jesus is saying really had a great, great impact. Now, what we have to say here is that there is a similar magical time around 1900 to 1920. Is a magical time where the teachers go back and say, people at this time didn't know what was going on, and they couldn't communicate, and they only had one conference, the Solvay conference, and guess what? All the big characters were there. Not Mickey Mouse, not Donald Duck, there was Einstein and all the other great people there, and this magical time. And since then, they thought perhaps it could be a wave, and perhaps, and they've rolled out the same lesson. It's sort of like talking about justice or taxation or something like that, by only using the Bible and not using any of the advanced history. But what I want to say is that there are a few things where we've got diffractions which have a major, major influence. One of them is holograms. Now, what's mentioned here is that I can see a little bit of diffraction pattern here and a bit on there. I want to mention holograms. This is where I have an object. I fire a laser beam at the object, a plane wave laser beam at the object. It reflects off the object. And then I have a photographic plate, an emulsive plate. It can be a one which absorbs the amount of light, but then I create an interference pattern between the light from my object and a reference beam, and so that carries through there, and then that interference pattern, when I later expose the reference beam to that same interference pattern, that absorption plane, it will modify the beam such that it gives the impression of the, it then distorts that reference beam in such a way. So the bottom line is that if I had the plate in front of me and I had the reference beam going to my eye, 99% of that light would go straight to my eye. It would be dreadful. However, if on the side, I can see scattered off that plate the wavelike property. So I can recreate anything I want there. In fact, I can so much so be sufficient able to compute this and actually etch and print a diffraction pattern on, and I can now very much produce a holographic three-dimensional picture on a surface, a white light surface, and I can create these holograms. So this is light wave properties, so that's an important aspect to do it. Another thing I want to talk about is that talk about computing it. I can get my computer to write a diffraction grating, and this is what happens here. So I get my computer, and the computer puts instructs the refractive index of a thin film, and actually constructs it, puts a picture of it, and this means that light hitting this beam can be then directed. So I have light hitting a surface, and I can then, on the flat surface, then steer the light for different wavelengths. And so what that means is that this is an Australian invention. The light comes out of an optical fibre and then gets steered into 10 or 12 other optical fibres. That is, we've got the telephone exchange with light and optical fibres. Real time, no moving parts, just a programmable diffraction grating. So that's real world things. What I have to say now is that the idea of it's called Huygens wavelengths. I can create a surface of little miniature oscillators, and the little miniature oscillator is a little stack optical fiber dot, which is a little laser. It's sort of a little, I think they're down to absolutely nanowatt tiny laser. Well, produces nothing, and this little dot produces light, and it's so small, much smaller than the wavelength of light across it actually produces this big fan of light. Go everywhere. It's because it's so small, the diffraction's so big, so it's not really a good laser. But the bottom thing is, it's so small and it's printed, you can actually print a whole surface. In fact, they can print a whole wafer of these things, the size of, two Weet-Bixes, three Weet-Bixes across. Or entirely small. That's called a Vixel, it's a surface layer. So they can actually print something and put energy into it, and it can produce light. Now, this is rather good because you can now have an object, and I can control the power and the phase now, and I can create what, from a little square, a Gaussian light source where there is actually no ripples on the outside. I can put a Gaussian profile of it, make it brightest in the center, tail it down, and get all the light from the diffraction side into that central beam. And I can produce basically a laser beam. So if I have a tiny laser, a pen laser, and I put it across a football field, it'll be the size of your head by the time it gets across there, just to do the size. But if I have something the size of your head, I can actually fire it a fair distance, a fair number of kilometers before it actually expands. So this is important. So I can actually print a piece of glowing paper with a laser beam on it, and that laser beam can actually now travel a huge distance, because it can actually use the wave property of light. I can simulate a wave on a piece of paper and send some light across. And this sounds a bit but there is more. I can actually put a bias voltage on it such that I can change the phase of the oscillation of them from one end to the other, and I can then for create a phase distance. So it looks as though the wave interferes in one point. It's called a phase array antenna. So in fact, I can do the opposite. I can have an antenna, and I can therefore add up. It could be made up of an array of really tiny antennas, and I can say, well, I'm only interested in the signal which is at, you know, out of phase by this much, coming from such a direction. So I can now have a flat antenna and can actually scan and look around the place. And so true for a laser. I can get this piece of paper laser, and it can produce an amazing couple of watts of light, and it can point in any, it can be fixed on a pole. I could paint it on the side of a house, or but light, I could have it there, and it can actually direct a couple of watts into a point a couple of kilometers away accurately within nanoseconds. And furthermore, it can oscillate and put gigabits of information across. Why would you want to do that? Well, as we speak, Elon Musk is deploying 7,000, close on 8,000 satellites in space, each with about four or five of these lasers and detectors on it, and solar panels, and it takes the lights and the watts of energy from the sun and converts the sun energy into a laser. And the lasers then fire between the 7,000 low Earth satellites and produce an optical fiber, an optical network which encompasses the globe. Kilowatts of energy going down for stuff. And what happens is that satellites are in a track. So satellites ahead and beneath can be put. So once you put light into a track, it can then illuminate all the light all the way up and down the track. And then the computers are such that it can actually go back and actually start to tell the laser. Once the laser gets roughly onto things, firstly, it can produce a broad beam. So it can reduce the amount of light in, and it can actually produce a fan of beams, right, and to intersect. And when one hits, the satellite that's been hit can send beam back to it, you're hitting me at the right spot, and then it can get the information back and actually program it in within a nothing of a second. And so we're producing the next generation of communication systems based on this. Now, the main incredible advantage of this is that you no longer have to have a huge economy. You don't have to be in a geographic, contiguously large economy. Like, you don't have to be South Korea next to China and Japan to want to have optical fiber systems, you know. Or as Australia has a long problem with these huge distances. I'm in the Australian outback. There is no way that I can justify $1 billion worth of energy. Now, that's not the last thing I want to talk about. So this is phase array energy. We've got these 7,000 satellites just above us. I think the first 60 or so have launched up, and they're working out how to do it. And they've got these lasers with no moving parts. So the beautiful thing is that the effect of a moving part, where I used to have a moving part to get things, I can remove that moving part completely from it by having a phase array antenna. Most beautiful of beautiful things to come across. Where else could it go along? Well, there's certain things of using phase array antenna in microwaves to get rid of the drum. You know how you had to rotate your chicken? Well, and essentially, playing around with it, you can actually get it to dance across the microwaves, to dance across your chicken. So that's one thing. But there is more. In terms of the problem with radiation and antenna and the new bandwidths of getting things is that it's desperately hard in terms of that if I have an antenna at the street corner and I want to, I've got five mobile phones going around the place and I want to get information out to it. I could actually have an antenna which saturates a whole area. So imagine you had a wall and you had five bricks in it which you had to paint with a certain colour. What you could do is you get a can and a thing of paint and paint the whole bloody wall. Or you could have a paint gun and fire the paint bullet directly at the brick. If you could know where the brick is, and then the brick can then guide your paint gun up to fire straight at it. So enter 4G, 5G. 4G, he goes in and says, is used for, hey brick, are you there? All right, I'm here, mate. What, like this? Where are you roughly? Over here. Okay, and then it goes through a protocol and starts to work out where the brick is. And your antenna, which is a phase array antenna up the top of the pole there, therefore directs and beams high energy, high frequency radiation directly at your phone. When I say high energy, it's no higher than normal, but the advantage is that you're now putting in a radiation energy in one direction and you're not radiating it everywhere else. So your phone has got this triple advantage: higher energy, less interference, because that 5G antenna is not spurting energy everywhere, it's only spurting to you, and so you're just making the transmission of data that much incredibly bigger. Now, also inside the room, inside the home. So 5G actually saves energy. It's got a certain amount of area, and it's just a generation. And people are saying, oh, how can I do it? The bottom line is that computers are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Like already, your mobile phone footage can get down to through fiber because it's got the most high-end Fourier error correction method to actually unscramble, to undo the disaster of the last couple hundred meters of copper wire. There's this beautiful error correction technology across that. So it's sort of one of these intense things. You've got a disaster of misinformation or uninformation or an unclarity at the start, and that really gets so far, and like a wounded, broken battleship, it sort of limps into shallow waters and in amongst islands, and it doesn't describe anything. But you could go further. But once when you go further, so it means that your valuable investment is directed to healing the injury of prior poor descriptions. And you're talking about, oh, if I stick a laser beam, I can see this refraction pattern over the edge, and that's a bit like a pond edge or something like that. But then what's happened is that the world has quietly said, oh, well, just as well, we don't have to educate everyone. We only have to educate 50, 500, somewhere between that number of scientists who really know what's going on. And that's all you really need to know to design the equipment to go into satellites and rockets. And so it's a similar number of people. That's all you really need to know to design 5G and stuff like that. And so there's this sort of bit of a paradox of questioning here. When you sort of have an answer to a question, sort of an insight into why teachers are teaching so badly, You didn't have your next question. Now I've understood it, but are there any further questions? Well, I do have a further question. How is the human race trucking along absolutely fine? We're teaching crap at school and we're doing fantastic things. The essential thing is that in the uptake, no one really needs to know it. No one really needs to know the advanced science. I think that's the take-home message, that no one really needs to know it. However, you don't really need to know. You don't really need to spend so much time teaching. It's sort of like, if you don't really need to know it, you could really teach history, philosophy, a whole, broaden the education, sort of wind it back from there. So thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.